30 years ago, President Reagan nominated Anthony Kennedy to the Supreme Court. The framers established that the Constitution is designed to secure the blessings of liberty. Justice Kennedy devoted his career to securing liberty. I am deeply honored to be nominated to fill his seat on the Supreme Court.
Last night, President Trump nominated Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. In the coming weeks, Kavanaugh is expected to face a difficult confirmation in the Senate. He's also one of the 25 judges handpicked by a group called the Federalist Society. And that's where we begin today.
Good morning. Such an obedient crowd. Thank you very much.
Every November, conservative and libertarian lawyers gather at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. for the Federalist Society's annual convention.
And I am very pleased that such a large and distinguished audience has joined us for this, the Federalist Society's 35th anniversary National Lawyers Convention.
That's Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society's 2017 gathering.
The dinner, the annual dinner this evening, will be a record breaker in terms of numbers of people attending. I'm also happy to report that our registration numbers for the convention this year exceed last year's numbers by a wide margin, and last year was a very good year.
The Federalist Society is made up of 60,000 practicing attorneys and more than 10,000 law students at more than 200 schools across the country. And they follow judges throughout their careers to make sure they're issuing conservative decisions and strict interpretations of the Constitution, including Brett Kavanaugh.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
So this nomination, it means it's been a very good year for the Federalist Society, and they've been at this for a very long time. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. So let's get some answers. Michael Avery is a professor emeritus at Suffolk University Law School and author of The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. Professor Avery, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with Kavanaugh himself. Why this candidate?
Well, Kavanaugh has been a member of the conservative establishment, legal establishment in Washington for quite some time. He worked for President George W. Bush. He worked for Ken Starr. In fact, he picked judges for President George W. Bush for the years he was in the White House before he himself was appointed to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So he has impeccable conservative credentials, and he is one of the pool of people that the Federalist Society has developed just to stand in line to get positions such as this.
Let's talk a little bit about the society, the Federalist Society's organization. What are their principles? Who funds this organization?
The Society is funded by very wealthy conservative philanthropists. Initially, they were funded by the John M. Olin Foundation and the Sarah Scaife Foundation. Later along came the Koch brothers and then many other conservative philanthropists. And the interesting thing about their funding is that almost all their money comes in the form of unrestricted funds. In other words, unlike liberal philanthropists who require organizations to say exactly what they're going to do with the money, these conservatives give money to the Federalist Society just to build up the society so it can pursue its aims.
Is there a liberal version of the Federalist Society?
Well, there's something called the American Constitution Society, which was founded after the Federalist Society and in opposition to it, but it's much smaller. It doesn't have the same amount of money. It doesn't have access to the network of other conservative groups that the Federalist Society has, and it doesn't have the same clout in Washington that the Federalist Society has.
What kind of qualifications? I mean, we're sort of speaking broadly here about conservative values, but what exactly was the Federalist Society looking for in its court nominees and when it put together this list of 25 potential nominees?
Well, the Federalist Society says that they simply interpret the Constitution the way it was written, but in fact, they have several core beliefs that are very important to them. Probably the most important is the primacy of private property. They think that private property is the single most important value protected by the Constitution, and therefore they oppose all sorts of government regulation, taking private property for public use, environmental regulations, anything that would interfere with what they perceive to be the God-given right of rich people to do whatever they want with their own property. They've also been very strong against affirmative action. They don't believe that race should be taken into account in admissions to schools or in hiring, notwithstanding the long history of racism and oppression in this country. They don't think that that should be taken into account in today's world. They've been opposed to abortion rights for women. They've aligned themselves with the right-wing religious fundamentalists in terms of state support for religion. They limit access to courts for workers, consumers, and others to try to get justice if they've been taken advantage of by more powerful people in society. So across the board, they have this conservative view. And also in foreign policy, they are very much in favor of American exceptionalism. Trump's notion that it's America first and international agreements be damned is very much in line with Federalist Society thinking.
Now, I'm wondering if past presidents looked to the Federalist Society, when they were culling nominations for the court. And if so, has the Federalist Society sort of taken on a more important role over the past couple of decades than it had prior?
Absolutely. Well, the Federalist Society was founded by law students in the early 80s, and of course, Ronald Reagan was elected president in 1980, and he came to Washington with Edwin Meese, who very early on appreciated the value of these young conservatives and gave them important positions in the White House and in the Justice Department, and eventually they played a role in helping select judges during the Reagan administration. Subsequently, for both Bushes, both George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, the Federalist Society members were actually holding positions in the White House, and Judge Kavanaugh held one of those positions for George W. Bush, picking judges. What the Federalist Society has done is to create a multi-lane highway, a network that extends from the law schools up through the law firms, clerkships for judges, positions in the Department of Justice. Eventually, their people got appointed to the bench in the district courts, the courts of appeals, and ultimately the Supreme Court. So Kavanaugh is only one of many fish swimming in this large pond that the Federalist Society has created, now three generations of conservative lawyers that they have developed and nurtured to be in positions of power.
In the aftermath of President Trump's SCOTUS nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, we're talking with Professor Michael Avery about how the Federalist Society works and who the group has influence over. I'm wondering, Professor, if you can tell us a little bit about someone named Leonard Leo. He's the executive vice president of the society, and he was influential in Trump's selection of Neil Gorsuch and, of course, Kavanaugh.
Leonard Leo is an extremely powerful person in Washington, D.C. He's a very conservative person. He's been with the Federalist Society his whole career, and he has access to tens of millions of dollars in funding to use to promote his agenda. The Federalist Society budget is only about $14 million a year, which is substantial, but he has access to tens of millions more than that through the Judicial Crisis Network and other organizations that Leo plays a role in. He contributed or assisted in contributing $1 million to Trump's inauguration. $1 million is nothing to Leonard Leo. They spent $17 million, the Judicial Crisis Network spent $17 million opposing Merrick Garland's nomination by President Obama to the Supreme Court. And they now intend to spend millions in the swing states in support of Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. So Leo has his finger on the lever of power. And he himself is very conservative, and he uses this in a variety of ways to promote his agenda and the Federalist Society agenda.
We know they're doing that at the public level, but what about the private, behind the scenes, the informal networks?
Well, these networks are huge. When George W. Bush was president, appointments of young lawyers to the Department of Justice were made on a litmus test basis, so that if you had the Federalist Society on your resume, you got the job. If you had American Constitution Society on your resume, you didn't. And then these lawyers work in the DOJ. They get credentialed there or in the White House or in other government agencies. Then they become partners in the big corporate law firms. Some of them go on the bench, and they filter throughout the entire power structure that affects law and policy in the United States.
Michael Avery is a professor emeritus at Suffolk University Law School and author of The Federalist Society: How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Lev. I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York. I'm just wondering, where is justice in all of this? The judges have become so political. They arbitrarily decide cases, essentially. And so there is simply no justice in the justice system. And judges are not preoccupied with justice at all. And if they were, they would have followed the due process. And then it wouldn't have mattered whether judges are conservative or liberal. The decisions would be the same.
William in Stoughton, Massachusetts, I think that the country needs to answer this question. Should judges be able to serve out life terms? Someone with like Ruth Bader Ginsburg at 85 years old, where the court itself is suffering because they're not able to decide cases as quickly as they should be. That's not the way the Supreme Court was fashioned to run. It was fashioned to run 150, 60 cases a year and to do the people's work.
We want to know what you think, listeners. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
And Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive.
They have all of our photos. They have all of our driver's license photos.
But now some police departments are using new technology.
He doesn't have to take his eyes away from the scene.
You put that into the systems, that's a vehicle you want to pay attention to.
He can be getting information from his equipment.
It's actually a GPS tracker inside.
Having that early detection can give him time to call for backup.
We find that government jumps feet first into these wide-scale surveillance programs.
All of our passport photos, mugshots, you name it.
They don't think through the protections before doing this.
And so they can take a picture off something like social media or even a camera on the street and use that to find someone.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and all week here on The Takeaway, we're looking at how police use technology to fight crime and how these technologies are changing our relationship to privacy in the name of public safety. For decades, police officers have been keeping track of alleged criminals, and today, one method of doing that is through what some people call gang databases. Victor Dempsey thinks he might be in a gang database here in New York City. Last fall, he was pulled over for failing to use his turn signal in what was supposed to be a routine traffic stop. But then things shifted.
So he escorts me to his cruiser, places me in the back of his cruiser. He did not sit me on the side of the curb. He did not place me to stand by the trunk of the car. I'm in his cruiser in handcuffs for a routine traffic stop. So as I'm fidgeting and I'm moving around and I lean forward, at the bottom of his monitor, there was a picture of me. And in like little red letters, it said SRG, Security Risk Group.
Security Risk Group. That's what Dempsey thinks the letters he saw meant.
At a younger age, before my days now, I was involved in a crew. I was actually a member of the Bloods gang.
When he was 17, Dempsey was arrested for attempted robbery and served 2 years in prison. Today, he's a community liaison with the Legal Aid Society. But Dempsey said he still feels as though his past is following him.
I'm 32 years of age now. I have not been in trouble since the age of 19. So all this time went by, and I'm still in a database.
Whether Dempsey is one of the more than 17,000 New Yorkers in the database will be almost impossible to find out. According to the New York Police Department, the database is private. We asked the NYPD about the SRG acronym, and they said it actually stands for something else. And we'll hear from them in a minute. But first, we go back to Victor Dempsey and Anthony Posada, a lawyer for the Legal Aid Society, and they are both sounding the alarm about the use of these gang databases.
To be placed into the NYPD gang database right now, as it exists, there is no requirement that a person commit wrongdoing or a crime.
So in other words, anybody could end up on the gang database, is that right?
That's correct, but I would just say that not just anybody, but primarily people who live in communities of color and in NYCHA buildings, where surveillance and gang policing has been really intensified.
And for those of our listeners who don't know NYCHA, NYCHA is a public housing, New York City housing authority here. Victor, when we sat down today, you handed me a bunch of papers, and one of them is the IDS gang entry sheet. Tell me what this is.
Yes. So the IDS gang entry sheet is what the NYPD is using as pretty much a bio sheet of some sorts with an added section for criteria. There's three sections to it. So the first section would be an individual openly admitting to being involved in some form of a crew or gang or whatever you want to call it these days. The second part to that is what they call a reliable source.
So I just want to stop a second, because so our listeners understand, these are the different ways that someone could end up on this database. One is by admitting, like I say, yes, I'm a member of a gang, right? Mm-hmm. That seems pretty straightforward. The second is if a trusted source, school safety officers, et cetera, can say that person is a member of a gang.
Mm-hmm.
But the third is meaning you have to meet two of the following criteria. Tell us a little bit about that.
So as we're looking at it now, there's six parts to this. One, the first, known gang location. What that means is any neighborhood or any area throughout New York City that the NYPD deemed to be a gang location or crew area where they're predominantly hanging out at, if you live in that area or you frequent that area, you could potentially be targeted as being inputted to this gang database. Scars, tattoos associated with gangs.
Colors. Hand signs.
Everything. And specifically hand signs. And I always bring this up because, you know, when we talk about our youth, right, labeling our youth, and I always relate this to basketball. When someone scores a bucket or a slam dunk or anything and they get excited, they have these handshakes that they make up just to show camaraderie, so to speak. So you mean to tell me that if someone does a handshake that's not traditional or has all this extra stuff to it, now that becomes a gang sign or gang handshake? To whose standards?
And let me be clear, just so I can be put in this database if I meet any two of these criteria. So let's say I'm wearing certain clothes and I'm living in a quote-unquote gang location. Will I be alerted to the fact that I'm entered into the database? If I get into the database in any one of these forms, does someone say, hey, Tanzina, you're in the database?
No, nobody will not. And I just want to go back to a point that Victor was making about that first category where self-admission is sort of the first prong to be entered into the database, because we have to put it in the context that The communities that we serve do not know what their rights are. The overwhelming amount of people do not know what their rights are. And so when we're talking about the 1,460 youth under the age of 18, minors who are in the NYPD gang database right now, we can tell you that when we go out to service communities and do workshops that are along the lines of knowing their rights with police interactions, so many of them tell us that they have been told by officers to get in the back of their squad cars and to give up their social media information, and they don't know what their rights are. So we need to take that first category in the context of, well, if people don't even know that they can tell the officer, I do not wish to speak to you, I want to speak to my attorney, they're already engaging in unlawful questioning that they don't know is incriminating them. And so all of those 1,460,000 minors, their parents are not being notified, will not be notified, have no way of challenging the inclusion or getting removed from it to begin with. And so what we are left with is this very un-American style of policing that invades our privacy, that does not give people the right to due process to challenge it, and that instead just says, well, because of this, then we need to criminalize your entire community.
We're going to talk to the NYPD as well, and I'm sure one of the things that they would say is, look, we need to know what we're dealing with, right? We need to know who's on the other side of the door before we go into a distress call. We need to understand, you know, if this person is dangerous or not. This is technology that's helping us do our job more effectively and keep New Yorkers safe.
If police officers and their tablets or smartphones now have access to these databases, and upon stopping somebody, they put their information and suddenly all this profile comes up with the very glaring label that says gang involved or gang affiliate, I'm going to respond very differently than if that label did not show up. And in the case of Victor, it prompted what would be a routine traffic stop to be more than just that. And the officer feeling that they had to use that amount of exertion of power because of the fact that the label was applied to Victor.
I want to thank Victor Dempsey, community liaison with the Legal Aid Society, and Anthony Posada, attorney with the Legal Aid Society, for joining me today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tanzina.
There are 17,500 people in the New York Police Department's gang database. Whether or not Victor Dempsey is on there is something we can't know for sure, but the NYPD does want to make one thing clear.
First, in New York, we don't call it a gang database.
That's Chief Terrence Monahan, New York Police Department's chief of department.
It's a criminal group database. It's a listing of people who associate together that engage in criminal activity. So it could be part of a gang, it could be part of a crew, it could just be a team of people that we know are organized together committing crimes. So it is a source of intelligence for us.
I talk with Chief Monahan to see how the database works and to press him on the concerns that people have about issues around privacy and its secrecy.
Well, the vast majority of them that are in the database are self-admitted. Someone that we've interviewed and said, yes, I'm part of this gang, I'm part of this crew. One of the other ways that we look at is if we have two separate reliable sources who say that an individual is part of a certain gang or crew. Besides that, we look at various other things that in conjunction, you know, you need two or more of these to kind of lead us to believe that you're in a database. That's if you frequent gang locations on social media, you're posting about being in a gang. Possession of gang-related documents, tattoos, identifying yourself as a member of a gang. Frequently wearing the colors, being seen making gang signs, certain symbols that are representative of certain gangs. If we have a combination of these sort of things, that can then put you into the database, the criminal group database.
And so the concern is, if I get into the database, I may not know that I'm in the database, right?
That's correct.
So how come I don't know if I'm in it?
Again, this is an intelligence gathering thing that we do. It's not for enforcement purposes. There is no negative aspect to you for being in this gang database. You can't be stopped because you're in a gang database. You can't be arrested because you're in a gang database or a criminal group database. It is just information for us so that we can determine what's going on in the streets. I can give you an example.
Sure.
We had shootings up in University Heights in the Bronx. Four people were shot. And that area is known to us and some of the people in the database as members of the Two Fly Crew. And now we know, based on that, that Two Fly Crew has a historic violence with a group from Mott Haven, the Mott Haven YGs, And it goes back to when a guy, Junta Perez, was killed back in 2012. Junta Perez was a leader of the YGs, and it's believed he was killed by someone up in the University Heights area. This shooting occurred on the anniversary of his death. So taking all that into things, we know now probably where to focus our investigatory angles.
So it makes sense that you would want your officers to be very specific, right? Not wasting a lot of time. So having a clear direction in which to go would obviously make sense. But some of the concerns that we're also hearing are that people who are under the age of 18 could end up in these databases.
When we look at the our database right now, the criminal group, the average age of anyone in there is 27 years old. When we looked at anyone underneath the age of 18, there was less than 2.5% of them. So 430 out of the current 17,500 that are in the database. So the majority, the vast majority, 97.5%, are over the age of 18.
We spoke today to a gentleman named Victor Dempsey. And Victor's a community liaison with the Legal Aid Society. He's also a formerly incarcerated individual. He says he believes he is on the gang database. And he said that, you know, during a routine traffic stop, he thinks that he was treated differently. But I want to play you a clip from what he's had to say.
So he escorts me to his cruiser, places me in the back of his cruiser. He did not sit me on the side of the curb. He did not place me to stand by the trunk of the car. I'm in his cruiser in handcuffs for a routine traffic stop. At the bottom of his monitor, there was a picture of me. And in like little red letters, it said SRG, Security Risk Group.
So this is something Victor told us happened after he was stopped. I wasn't there. We didn't see it for ourselves, but want to bring it up because he's bringing that up as a concern.
Yeah, SRG stands for Strategic Response Group. It's most likely where those officers were assigned to.
So it had nothing to do with him specifically?
No, they probably just ran a license check on him. I don't know the whole circumstances of this stop, but SRG, I can tell you, stands for Strategic Response Group, which is the unit that police officer was assigned to.
So is there a question about due process in this database? Let's say, for example, I end up in the database, right? And I'm not aware that I'm in the database. Is there any way that I can find out that I'm on it? Is there any way that I can get off of it if I find out that I'm on it?
No. At this point, again, it's an intelligence gathering thing. Not because you're in the database are you going to be looked at. But if you're in that database, there's a chance that you may be part of an ongoing case where we know that you're involved in some sort of activity. So it isn't like we look at someone, oh, you're in a gang member, we're going to round them up. No, this is focused. Precision policing at its best. We want those individuals, the small number of individuals that are trigger pullers, we want to be able to identify them and prosecute them.
I guess the big question that comes up with this type of technology is what happens if I don't know I'm on it, right? Like if I don't know I'm in this database and what if this data is then shared with other agencies or other databases? Is that happening?
This is an internal database. It is shared with no one. We don't share with prosecutors. We don't share it with any federal authorities. We don't share it with housing authorities. And the only time you're going to get prosecuted is if you commit a crime. So if somehow you ended up on this database and you're not committing crimes, you're never going to have any effect. We're very precise at what we want to do, how we get people into this. We want to be right. We want to make sure that, you know, we're getting good information. You know, garbage in, garbage out is the old technology. So we want to make sure that we have the right thing. So we go through a real checklist before you can make it into the system.
Before you can even get into the system. Because sometimes you can say, well, you know, I mean, I grew up in a community that I think would be considered sort of low income. And, you know, I think there's a sense that people might even feel that they're being surveilled, or they'll just feel like if I see my friend, you know, who is in the gang, and I take a quick picture with them or her, then suddenly I'm going to end up in this database, and I had nothing to do with that.
Right? No, again, it takes a lot more. And if you look at who's in our database, out of the individuals in there, 17,500, 500 murders have been committed by the people that are within this database, 18,000 robberies. The average person, 90% of them have been arrested at least once for a felony, and the average person in the database has 11 arrests, 5 of which are felonies. So for the normal person who doesn't commit crime, who isn't a criminal, they have nothing to worry about. We are not doing any mass looking at everybody. If we're looking at someone, it's because we have information, and it's focused and it's precision, it's precise on who we're looking at and who we have to go after. And those are the people that are involved in violence. I mean, just take a look at the city and how it's working. 1990, 2,240 homicides. Last year, 289. And we're doing it with a lot less arrest. We're not arresting as many people. So that's our focus in this criminal group.
Chief Terrence Monahan is New York Police Department's chief of department. That conversation was part of our week-long look at security and privacy. And you can check out the whole series called Secret Policing on our website, thetakeaway.org. More tomorrow on the show. Does the Constitution guarantee the right to an education? Last week, a federal judge said no. In 2016, 7 students in Michigan sued the government, saying they had a basic right to learn to read and write in school, and that their underfunded inferior education in Detroit had denied them that right. But Judge Stephen Murphy said in his ruling last week that as devastating as the conditions in those Detroit schools are, the Constitution provides no protection for literacy. Not everyone agrees with that interpretation. Derek Black is a professor of law at the University of South Carolina, specializing in education.
The federal district court said there is no right under the federal constitution to literacy. Now, we do have state constitutions in all 50 states that do protect the right to education. So if you went into state court, you could have got get a different decision in a lot of states. But at the federal level, there's very limited ability to pursue education rights.
I mean, it's still sort of surprising to me that that's not part. We have the pursuit of happiness, but education doesn't seem to be a part of that.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that the word education doesn't appear in the federal constitution, and I think that's the biggest challenge to get over. How could the constitution protect something if it doesn't mention it? But we had lawsuits back in the 1970s that went all the way to the Supreme Court. The case was San Antonio versus Rodriguez, where, you know, civil rights advocates had tried to argue that basically, the right to education was connected to so many other things like free speech and voting that the constitution implicitly protects it. But the court rejected that idea in San Antonio versus Rodriguez. And so we have these newer cases trying to identify some narrower aspect of education that maybe the Constitution protects, like literacy. Like, how could you function as a citizen if you're not literate? And so people have gone for a narrower right, but this lower court just said no to that as well.
So what is the federal government's role in ensuring that Americans are provided with an education? Is there no role at all? I mean, they have the Department of Education.
Right. Well, the Department of Education is really about spending money and getting things back in exchange for it. So it's kind of like a contract between the federal government and the states. But my research has actually said that there is a federal role in education, and that's that our Constitution does guarantee everyone a Republican form of government in the states. It's actually Congress's job to make sure all states have a Republican form of government. And that's sort of a fancy constitutional term for democracy. But, you know, my research has shown that at the end of the Civil War, when Congress is trying to put our democracy back together and we've got, you know, a couple million slaves in the South who've been denied the right to read, been denied the right to vote, been denied all rights, and for that matter, a lot of poor whites were suffering in terms of education and voting as well, that Congress said, look, Southern states, if you want to become part of this democratic union again, you got to do 3 things. You got to ensure that everyone gets to vote. You got to provide public education to all your citizens, and you have to enact the 14th Amendment. So I argue that from that point forward, what we see is that the federal constitution does require states to provide public education to its citizens.
But going back to the requirement of a public education, what about the quality of that education? We mentioned the DOE is the Department of Education obviously funds certain initiatives. So there is a role that the federal government is playing. And I would ask you, what role is that when it comes to the quality of education, not just the right to be educated, but to have a good education?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we were trying to bring these states back into the union, Congress wanted them to do more than just open the doors and let kids sit around all day. They wanted those kids to be prepared to participate as citizens. And that meant understanding how government functions. That meant critical literacy to understand the debates that were going on in the newspapers and to respond to them and to come out and vote. And so critical literacy was key back then. And I think, you know, as we're in this age of so-called fake news or you know, lots of differing accounts of the same story on the internet, our kids really need that critical literacy to sort what's true from what's false and to understand government. And unfortunately, our children don't have that in Detroit. They don't have it in most places, to be quite honestly.
I'm curious about what happens now. Can these kids go back and appeal? Is there any way to move this issue forward? Because it just seems to me like it's a little unfair in some ways.
Well, unfair is certainly a good word for it. I mean, you know, the life chances of kids in Detroit are a lot different than kids everywhere else. And the idea that, you know, their legislators won't do anything about it and the courts won't interject is certainly sad. But as to next steps, you know, the next step is an appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we'll see what happens there. But I will tell you that the earth has sort of moved in the last 2 years. You know, when that case was first filed in Michigan, and there's a similar one in Connecticut, and there's a third one in Mississippi, I was really quite optimistic, right, back in 2016, early 2016, that they might have a fighting shot to have their constitutional rights vindicated. But we've seen the United States Supreme Court grow a little bit more conservative with our previous appointment, and now we've got a new one heading that way. And it's kind of scary for me to think that these kids had a fighting chance, and I'm not sure they do. So, you know, there's a lot more at stake than, you know, abortion and health care. It is the future of the education of all our children, I think, that hangs in the balance of this Supreme Court nominee.
Derek Black is professor of law at the University of South Carolina, specializing in education. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So what do you think? Should children be guaranteed the right to an education in U.S. schools?
This is Kyle from Orlando, Florida. If the U.S. is going to be competitive and progress with the rest of the world, we need to guarantee the highest levels and most effective methods of education. Otherwise, what's the point?
I have always thought that this is just an automatic yes. They have the right to literacy, and they must be taught how to read and write. Schools should not be allowed to run if they don't teach children the life skills that they need to be productive citizens.
This is Max from Stoughton. A child learning how to read and write is an essential right in our country. A well-educated and informed populace is key to the survival of our democratic republic.
And a listener from Bellevue, Washington sent us this text, quote, "Literacy is a privilege, not a right. That being said, it's a privilege that we as a society should support and endeavor to provide to everyone. It benefits the recipient and society as a whole." And what do you think? Is literacy a right? Join the conversation on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway, and I'm at Tanzina Vega. And remember, if you want to add your voice to the conversation, you can sign up to be part of our listener response network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply. And you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our listener response network. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Fracture, creating modern photo decor by printing their customers' photos directly on glass. A Fracture is image, frame, and mount all in one, available in a selection of square and rectangle sizes. Learn more at fractureme.com/takeaway.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.